Once more into the breach. Let me try this again. Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, more or less, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this November 18th, 2017. And if it is November 18th, 2017, where you are, or maybe if it's the 19th, I guess. I guess it, on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, it could be the 19th and they could be listening to us.
Well, which side are we talking about of the Pacific Ocean? Because if they're is on Australia on a side of it?
Yes, it's definitely on the west side. It's
kind of wraps
there's the east side and the west side, and there's a line down the middle that divides us, and we can't even ever be in the same day.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
So if you're in Australia and you're listening, well,
Japan.
Do you call us up over? That's the big question. We call you down under. Do you call us up over?
Anyway, if today is November 18th or 19th, wherever you are, then you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 773-1400. Local area code is 254-773-1400. And by the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And we are not only the guys who talk on this show. It's not a show. This program. It's not really a program because we don't have it programmed in advance. Anyway, this thing that we do on the radio and the internet, we're also the two principals of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, that just happens to have the same name as the radio program, the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission as our primary regulator. Which implies no approval or disapproval from them. I could just go on like this all day. Anyway, the stuff we talk about on here is not investment advice. It is education, and it's important to note the difference, and we need to note the difference. Also, the stuff that we talk about on here is are items we've received and extracted and gathered from what we consider to be normally reliable sources, but we don't make any guarantees.
Right.
And the future is uncertain. We can be really – that's a disclosure that I give every day probably 20 times. My wife says, what time will you be home this evening? And I say, the future is always uncertain. I can make no promissory statements.
This makes her very happy, I'm sure.
No.
No.
No. She wants a promissory statement.
She's telling the truth and – yeah. Mm.
So what else is new?
Well, let's see. This week in our – week of the world, as opposed to somebody else's week in another part of the world, which may start at different times and end at different times, we have different beginnings and ends of our week here, too, whether it begins on Monday or Sunday. What is the seventh day? Well, it depends on which day you start counting from.
Okay, well, then let's back up a little bit.
Okay, all right. So what has happened in the week, as we would generally call it?
Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 0.27%. The S&P 500 was down 0.13%.
So these are 0.27 and 0.13?
In other words, not much.
It was a somnolent week with a lot of news.
Year to date, the S&P 500 is still up over 15%, and it is up almost 19% from a year ago. So the market's in healthy condition as far as if you like gains and don't like losses reported. And it's been coasting around with very little movement for the past several weeks. And there's a reason for that. I think one of the important things to understand is the hyped Sturm und Fury that is coming out of Washington is apparently largely ignored by the market.
Yeah.
Which is good, because every time we think we know what, oh, this is the tax proposal and it's going to change everything and it's going to wreck the investments.
Quick, memorize all the rules.
And
then
the
market, change them all.
The market bobs around the tiniest little bit, but not much. And the reason is we have really, really good corporate earnings. We have typically about 64% of corporate earnings in a quarter are higher than the analysts expected. And this quarter so far, with about 91% of the companies reporting in the S&P 500, we've had 73% of them higher. Now, that doesn't sound like 64 or 73. what's the difference? Well, it was either 60, it was either 60, 73 or 77. Maybe it's 77% now. But the point is, what we're seeing is corporations having better earnings and better revenues than expected, and also doing so at a rate higher than they traditionally have. It's traditional that since 2000 anyway, that analysts come out with earnings and revenue expectations that are a little on the low side, and they do that because some of them went to prison for making them on the high side.
Right. Those of you that don't recall that back in 2000, the whole Enron, Arthur Andersen, and all of that good stuff, it was also wrapped up with analysts over-predicting earnings on a regular basis because, and sometimes for pay from the companies they were analyzing. Well, that's not legal anymore. You're not allowed to over-inflate earnings unless you have a really good reason to think that earnings are going to go up, which they didn't at the time. So most analysts under-expect on the earnings side because there's something about the federally run gated communities that cause these even white-collar folks to go, I don't want to go there.
Federally run gated communities. I don't think I've ever heard anybody call it that.
Well, uniform required. It's a very posh institute. Only certain people are allowed in. You have to be in a certain group of people to be allowed. You would think this is the group that would love this. I mean, it's an exclusive gated community with uniforms and metered exercise times. It sounds like a detox facility or something.
Well, it is in a sense a detox facility, you know. And I don't know that it is the visit to the vacation site at Fort Leavenworth or wherever they go that turns them off as much as the fact that the government comes in and takes a whole lot of billions of dollars from them in
many cases. For some reason, they don't like that either. But how do you think they're going to pay for the gated community?
Well, I got you. I think, you know, I wonder – I never really thought about this before, but it's entirely possible – that what we could if we just put enough billionaires in jail and took all their money.
Nero did it,
but so did whatever his name is that died down in Venezuela.
Oh yeah, Chavez.
Yeah, Chavez.
Whatever his name is. The great revolutionary leader.
Right, he took
Hugo.
Hugo. Hugo. Oh yeah, he got the Hugo Award.
Yes.
Birth. He basically said if you put all the rich people. Now, Russia's trying that.
Yeah, Russia's trying it, and so is Saudi Arabia, as a matter of fact. Doesn't matter if you're in the family.
The problem is it makes very good sense. You know, we could balance the budget. We could do lots of things like that. The difficulty is everybody who's tried it seems to wind up in financial difficulties.
Yeah, and eventually, if you get rid of all of your business leaders, then your businesses don't run very well. Venezuela is a great example of that. You basically just nationalize all these companies. Make them one big company, and put your uncle in charge of it. Should be fine, right?
That'll work.
Yeah, he's good at bringing his side dish to Thanksgiving, so he should be good at running a multinational corporation. Should be fine.
Yeah, I like that.
It doesn't work very well.
It doesn't?
Yeah, that's what we have discovered again and again.
Robert Mugabe did it for, 60 years now?
Yeah, but they don't really have any multinational anything.
Well, and he just got thrown out, but, you know, 60
years.
Sort of.
Not really thrown out. He's in house arrest, and he did show up at a graduation in his role as the duly elected leader of the country.
Well, you know, he
just doesn't have any other power.
So they have term limits, but it's 60 years.
It's arbitrary.
And it's enforced by the military.
Right.
You know, we could write that into the Constitution. Anyway, as far as the economy is concerned, there are some relatively interesting things going on. By the way, again, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number to call in here if you'd like to join with us, ask any questions or comments about anything to do with economics, the economy, investing, money, or things of that ilk.
Not sports.
Right. 254-773-1400.
There's a funny little piece of British terminology here. They do not call sports sports. They call it sport, as in singular, not plural. But
they take the S and move it over to math.
Right. So they think that math is short for mathematics, which has an S at the end. So they say maths. So really what's going on is in the United States, we fought a revolution so that we could move the S from maths to sports.
And in New England, which is parallel to England, they take the R's and move them around randomly.
Yes, they take the R out of ca for car.
Yeah, but they put it on other words.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that ends
Washington.
With, well, no, they put it at the end of words.
They export a lot of their R's down to the Carolinas where they say things like Washington. See, it's just an exported R. That's all it is.
The R's move around, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are some things that are going on of significance, and a couple of them are obscure.
As obscure as sports and maths and
far more
Washington.
Actually more obscure. One is that interest rates are rising. You know, we've talked about when interest rates rise and they're still low. Yeah, that's true. But they're considerably higher than they were last year. So what I did is I took a look at one of the no-load index emulating bond funds that is available to be used. And that's the reason I like to look over at a mutual fund is people don't actually invest directly. You can't invest directly in an index, particularly a bond index.
Yeah, bond index are strange creatures.
And over the last 12 months, while the S&P 500 is up nearly 20%, you know, week to week, it's around 20%, although that's going to go away as time goes on. That bond fund is down 2.75% with all dividends reinvested, all the interest reinvested. It's one of those no load, low expense funds, and I just kind of glanced at it at random.
Yeah, that's
down 2.75%.
At the same time that more people are putting more money into bond funds.
Yeah, and that's something that I think is worth being aware. I think a lot of people are just unaware that's going on. It's a quiet thing. Interest rates are coming up. There is a broad consensus that in December, the Fed is going to lift short-term interest rates again, but that's not a big deal. Frankly,
that doesn't affect mortgage rates or long-term bonds at all.
And there's a couple of things happened this week in the bond markets that, again, for geeky people who are interested in what's really going on in the economy underneath.
Which would be 100% of our one person listening.
But it's 100% of the two of us.
Right.
Long-term interest rates, like out at 20 and 30 years for treasuries, are lower now than they were a year ago. They've come down, which is kind of the reverse of what most people expected, and I had to really dig around. And it turns out that the Treasury Department, there was an announcement this last week by Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, in addition, while he was holding up a sheet of freshly printed $1 bills with his signature on them. He announced that they were going to that the Treasury was going to go short, meaning they were going to stop selling long-term bonds at these amazingly low interest rates, and instead take their borrowing to really, really short-term bonds, which have even lower interest rates, which bamboozles my mind. And the reason it bamboozles my mind, if I have the ability at this point to borrow money at about 2 or 3% for 20 or 30 years, man, why not? Interest, inflation will probably be that high over that period. That's a zero-cost loan, in essence. But if I instead go to short-term loans where I just have to keep rolling them over, yeah, in the short term, it'll cost less because the interest rate is even lower. It's kind of like right now, if you were to buy a house or you to refinance a house, going for an annual renewable rate, YRTs, I think they're called, yearly renewable something, mortgage, where they adjust the rate each year. If interest rates go up, your interest rate will go up. And if interest rates go down, your interest rate will go down.
An adjustable rate mortgage?
Yes, an adjustable rate mortgage.
All right.
ART.
ARM.
ARM, yeah, ARM. ARMs are not real popular right now, and they're not real popular because interest rates are near record lows, and you can get a 30-year mortgage for 3-point-something%, depending on how big of a house you've got and how big the mortgage is and your credit rating and a lot of things. So people get these long-term mortgages because they say, whoa, what a deal, low interest rates, the longer I can lock this in, the better. Well, the Secretary of the Treasury announced that he wasn't going to do that. He was going to stop doing that, and he's going to move back to really, 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 really short-term borrowing, which means that the long-term bonds start to come into short supply. And when they go into short supply, their price goes up. When their price goes up, the resulting interest rate goes down, which explains why long-term interest rates are coming in, which is good, by the way, if you're looking at a long-term mortgage, because that means long-term rates are continue to be low, and which may be why housing starts hit a 12-year high last month.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you like that segue?
It was very nice. We just had one of the biggest housing starts months. As you said, it's biggest since 12 years ago. It's actually larger than 12 years ago as a percentage of new mortgages. Is it change from the month before? There's a lot of ways of measuring this. This is a big deal. A lot of people are going in to say, let's build a house.
Well, 12 years ago was 2007, so.
Do you calculate your 12? I'm just curious about that, because I would say that was 2005.
2005, I'm sorry. It was 2005.
You're right. You're right in that,
yeah,
that the housing
right.
Starts in 2005 led to the glut in the supply in 2007.
I had a 9 stuck in my head from 2009, and I bumped us into 2019 when we weren't looking.
Oh, okay. Well, that's how time travel works. We just have to get that laid out.
The other thing is that I didn't see reported anywhere, and I think except in very minor way down in the back end of the Wall Street Journal and so on, because of all the discussion over the tax proposal speculation, and this one does this, and this other one does that, and the Senate one does this, and the House bill did that.
Right.
Industrial production in October rose 0.9%, which just doesn't sound like, oh, well, big deal, just under 1%. Well, that's nearly 12. So if we just did that every month, that's an 11.35% annualized rate of growth in industrial production in the United States of America.
Right.
Which it's been many decades since we've seen the kind of growth that we saw in October. Now, some of that was catch up from the hurricanes, but we saw catch up from the hurricanes in September when we had 0.4% growth. Some of it is increase in production because of the devastation from the hurricanes, where they're starting to build stuff to replace the stuff that unstuffed when the hurricane unstuffed
it
us.
Was unstuffed and restuffed and now replacing stuff.
But the biggest piece, and I'm excited about this. Can you tell I'm excited?
I can tell.
Was Earl in gas.
Earl, as in the black gold?
Yeah, Texas tea.
Yeah, oil.
And, yes. And
I have a lot to talk about on that subject, too.
The IEA, I'm sure all of our listeners follow
with
bated breath the announcements from the IEA.
They are very distant cousins of the DEA. No, not at all. They're the International Energy Administration.
Agency. Yes.
So if you ever need agents from the International Energy to appear,
people with a lot of international energy. Anyway, they announced their analysts had come to the conclusion that the growth in U.S. oil output will be the strongest seen by any country in the history of oil.
Yeah.
And between now and 2025. And at that point, and sometime before that point, they stated, and I looked at where they got their numbers and have to completely agree with them, the United States of America will be the undisputed leader among global oil producers. We will be an equivalent of what Saudi Arabia was in the 70s.
And we're getting there very quickly.
Right. And the reason is, we've said over the years, the largest oil reserves in the world, without any question, unaccessible until recently, were in the continental United States. Shale oil.
Yeah, what you get when you're doing hydraulic fracturing.
But the issue is there was no easy way to get it out that it could be gotten out economically with given the price of oil. And then new technology comes along, and suddenly we are the equivalent of OPEC.
I was digging through some old radio programs from 10 years ago. And in the process, I'm going to need to find these and dig them out and get the sound bites and play them again at some point. But it's just one of those things that it almost seems narcissistic to pull back our predictions and say, look, we were right. But we talked about fracking when oil was getting up to the $100 a barrel mark.
Yes, we did.
This is absolutely untenable. People will start.
We will find a technology to fix this.
And we even talked about fracking being the thing to do because it had already been tried. It was tried during the 70s. It was tried during the 60s. It wasn't done with computers. It was done basically you turn a nozzle by hand and kind of aim the nozzle underground again by hand with cranks and levers, and it was very difficult. It was very dangerous. It was time-consuming, and it was expensive. And back in the 70s, they said at that point that oil would need to be up at around $30 a barrel for it to be profitable. Well, inflation took place, and in 2007, what we were talking about is it is now profitable to do fracking. At $50 a barrel, it's profitable. At $100 a barrel, it is extremely profitable. And at $120 a barrel, it is so lucrative that everybody will be doing it. So pretty much everybody started doing it. And this is why we had a lot of fracking companies fail, because they all started doing it at the same time, and they brought the price down so quickly, down to 40 from 100, that a lot of the companies that were set at $100 of lucrative income and were giving each other bonuses and buying really nice cars didn't have any money left to run the fracking. The technology has continued to improve there, and it's not just improving here. There's a bigger political and social resistance to fracking in Australia, but they're doing it, and they're doing it with American companies, and that means that the centers for oil are moving away from the Southwest Asia and Northern Africa regions and into developed countries who are interested in better environmental well-being, but also have other industries, so they grow their other industries with the oil, unlike Southwest Asia and Northern Africa. Basically, no other industries have grown in that area because they didn't need to. They were so lucrative. As the prices drop, this is why we have the instability in the Middle East. We're going to see that more. We're going to see more instability in the Middle East, not because of some political movement, but because of an economic fact.
Well, you were talking about taking people's money in Saudi Arabia,
right? The new crown prince has been arresting
Mohammed
royal family members left
bin
and right.
Salman.
And the prime minister of Lebanon in the middle of that.
He didn't get arrested. He just went to Saudi Arabia and resigned.
Yes, and then he wouldn't return to Lebanon until the president of France, Macron, said, please come and have talks with us. So he's showing up in France today, at which point – and he's being greeted as the prime minister
mm-hmm.
in France.
Well, his resignation has not been accepted by the legislature.
Right. So then,
so he's technically still the prime minister.
After France, he's going to go back to Lebanon. And right. Then we will know for sure whether or not he resigned or not. Here's the deal, is that the new – you were saying his name, the new crown prince.
See, just like you can say the name of the North Korean rocket man.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, see, I never can remember his name, but I know Mohammed bin Salman because it makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know what Kim Jong-un means.
So Salman is arresting senior family members. Mohammed bin Salman, yes.
Yeah, Salman is the family.
Yeah, Mohammed is arresting senior royal family members left and right and in the middle and seizing their assets, and they are unlikely to be seen again. He is cementing his place as the next king.
And one of the things, and I read some interesting commentary from people who are familiar with what goes on in the palace with the king there. apparently the issue is they recognize that the day is coming when oil no longer is going to be able to provide the kind of money that they need to run their country. As a matter of fact, right now they are dipping into reserves on a regular basis.
Their reserves are shrinking rapidly.
And that's another reason, by the way, interest rates have declined. I know that's going to sound really goofy. But the interest rates are behaving in a peculiar fashion that has very little to do with the U.S. economy right now. And U.S. interest rates, because it's a global world that we're in, and the Saudis are selling U.S. treasuries, not because they don't think U.S. treasuries are a good idea. They're selling
they need the money.
Because they need the money. And
that causes interest rates to rise slowly over time.
Yeah, and they're selling midterm right now. And if they ever start selling long-term, it'll turn around and go the other direction. Anyway,
right.
It's a really complicated area. It's really weird. But he is vigorously interested in changing the status quo, and apparently, at least that's the reports that the commentaries that I've read, in The Economist, which seems to have a pretty good grasp on these things compared with other publications, is that he sees the handwriting on the wall, to use the term. He sees that the day is coming when the United States is going to be much bigger than Saudi Arabia in oil, and they no longer can control the price. They no longer are going to have the huge cash flow coming in. And he looks around and says, we're already in a position where it's costing us more to run this country than we're getting in revenues. We better start making some changes right now. And he is interested in one of the things that's happened apparently over the years is they've turned a blind eye to princes. Then there's thousands of them.
Lots of them, yes.
Who conduct what are technically illegal business deals with oil and with foreign countries, and they set things up, and these Saudi princes just get away with being bribed and bribing other people and acting the kind of way that
we expect them to act, actually.
We would expect a bunch of Saudi princes to act who have unlimited money. And he's basically saying that was illegal when you did it. You knew it was illegal. You've been flaunting the law for a long time, and you've gained a bunch of illegal money. And really, it boils down to something fairly simple. When they gained all that illicit money, they didn't pay taxes on it.
Right.
It's the Al Capone syndrome.
Yeah, and there's
You can do all kinds of illegal things and get in a limited amount of trouble, but as soon as you don't pay taxes on your illegal profits, you're in trouble.
If you start looking at the fund flow data, the movement of money across foreign exchange markets and into large liquid holding facilities here and there, you'll find that after these arrests started, there was a mass exodus of money from Saudi Arabia. And the fact that the Prime Minister of Lebanon, who came to meet with the Crown Prince and then with no prior announcement, no, and his family members said, we don't know why he was doing this. He hasn't talked to us about it. The whole people of Lebanon are saying, what? He's announced on Saudi Arabian television, on the government-run station, that he was resigning his prime ministership from Lebanon. Let's kind of be clear here. Lebanon has a very strange status in the Arab and Middle Eastern world. They have a lot of factions. Those of you that are slightly older will remember the whole long-running battle of Beirut with huge numbers of factions, very similar to what's going on in Syria right now with huge numbers of factions. Sort of what's going on in Iraq. You've got Shia and Sunni. Well, that's a really simplistic way of looking at it. There's lots of factions of each of those. And as soon as one of them begins to get more powerful, they fracture into lots of little warring parties, which kind of is symbolic of what happens in the United States. When the Republicans take all the power, they start warring amongst themselves. When the Democrats take all the power, they start warring amongst themselves until big enough cracks appear. That's what's going on there. And until it truly solidifies with kind of an iron grip across the Middle East, we're going to see a lot of chaos there as they realize that some people are looking ahead. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is looking ahead and saying that oil is not going to be there forever. Most people are not looking ahead. They're just looking around and saying life is not as good as it once was. And that's a problem. That's, you know, kind of the birth of the Arab Spring.
And associated with that, as we go along this trail of news, all of which are linked together globally, there's a couple of little pieces in this next subject I want to talk about that are interesting. If I were to ask, if there are any listeners, what nation in the world has the biggest sovereign wealth fund? That the nation actually runs an investment fund for itself, and it has control of it, and it don't look it up. Don't type it into Google. But I just wondered if anybody knew which one it was, because it made a move, or at least its chief advisor advised it to make a move this week that tells you a lot about what's going on in the big wide world. Any 773-1400. Give me a call and tell me.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think they might look it up.
Well, yeah, I guess it won't work.
We can give a hint.
I'll just tell you what it is.
We'll give a hint first, because
it's not Saudi Arabia and it's not China.
But the hint's not going to help much. The sovereign wealth fund was mostly funded by oil,
which obviously would be either Russia, because
Russia,
it has the
Saudi Arabia,
nope,
neither
or Kuwait, or no. And the phone's not ringing.
No. We're not getting a call here. We may have to.
Well, it could be no one's listening. Anyway.
I'm not listening.
It's Norway.
Yeah.
Norway has a $1 trillion plus sovereign fund. That's like your personal piggy bank fund, rainy day fund of $1 trillion. Trillion.
With a T, an M.
In other words, it's a really, 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 really big number. And they started it when they hit oil in the North Sea. And it's still one of the standard outside the U.S. Oil benchmark is Brent North Sea oil, which is largely owned by Norway. And Norway had a huge surplus of money. And they said, we're just going to invest that money. And not coincidentally, they said oil is such a good deal. We'll invest a lot of money in oil and gas around the world, and they'll buy all kinds of things. But the Norges Bank, which manages the $1 trillion fund, recommended the minister should take steps to get completely out of the oil and gas business. I want you to think about that just a second. The world's largest fund investment advisor, which apparently has done a pretty reasonable job.
Yeah, they've gotten about a 6.5% rate of return over the last 10 years.
They
it's
said,
not bad for that much money.
They
at all.
Said, we're looking down the road. Oil's going to get really, really cheap, and there's going to be there's not a lot of gains going to be made there, and a lot of losses are going to occur. That announcement, by the way, came on the same day as the IEA said the United States of America was going to dominate between now and 2025 and going forward, will dominate the world petroleum markets. And Norway said, whoops, there's a whole bunch of oil and gas coming onto the market. And guess what? At the same time, Europe is saying, countries in Europe are saying, we're going to go by about that time, 100% electric.
Right.
You won't be able to have an internal combustion engine in your car, which means we're going to use less oil. That tells us something. Very, very profound.
Very clearly, very loudly. There's a couple of areas like that. And do you mind if I expound a moment on the philosophy of what's going on here?
Well, it all depends on whether you're talking about the British pound.
No, X pound. The dollar used to be the
pound. Is that
like
the
X
Brexit?
Pound. Sort of.
Okay. Well, okay. You
it's
can
the X pound. I'm going to expound.
I want to see an X pound.
All right.
I want to see an X pounding.
What we're seeing here, when Saudi Arabia looks at America dominating the oil market, that means something very, very different than Saudi Arabia dominating the oil market. The Saudis and the whole group in OPEC look at the oil market as their only source of revenue, and it's government-owned. So keep that in mind at the beginning. Only source of revenue, government-owned. They are trying to milk the cash cow They don't want to kill the cash cow. They want that cow to stay healthy and strong for as long as possible. But they're not really good and don't have a lot of understanding of what it is that keeps a cow healthy. So they've hired other people to keep the cow healthy for them. And then they make decisions on how much to milk their cattle. It's a pretty good analogy there, because oil wells need upkeep. And the Saudis don't even have their own companies with their own workers to do upkeep on their own oil wells. Those are mostly run by foreign people. So there are companies involved. Saudi Aramco hires Westerners mostly to come and, you know, whether people from Northern Ireland or from Great Britain or from the United States, those are the majority. There's some people from Russia that they bring in to upkeep oil wells. Sometimes France, but they're not the best here. If they want nuclear power, they'll go to Russia or France. But if they're talking about oil upkeep, they want to come to Texas or to the UK. And what that means is they don't know even what's making their income stream stay. If the United States, on the other hand, is in charge as far as oil production goes, and that's kind of a misleading term, because it isn't the government of the United States. Unlike OPEC, these are a bunch of governmental-run institutions. Governments make up OPEC. In the United States, companies make up. It's the free market, and they will compete as long as it's profitable or as long as they have money to lose to try to gain market share. And we like things to be profitable, so we find better ways of taking care of the cows, better ways of making them produce more milk or producing more cattle, or synthesizing milk out of something else. In this case, we're talking about fracking and new technologies that come along for fracking.
It's basically like having your bulls and your steers give milk.
Yeah. You just have everything able to give milk. If you figure out the right way to do it, you can have a lot more milk.
But with your relationship with milk, I think that's – well, wait a minute. You're drinking petroleum, drinking milk has about
the
same effect on you.
That's pretty much the same for me.
Yeah, okay.
So the long-term implication of the United States being the dominant – role in the world market is cheaper oil for everyone. The long-term implication of OPEC being in charge of oil is very expensive oil forever, because the motivation is different. We are trying to compete with each other as much as we can to stay profitable and sell as much oil as we can, which causes us to innovate and find new ways of doing things. We're the ones that innovated the ways that the Saudi Arabians are pulling their oil out of the ground.
As a matter of fact, the company that technically owns the oil and the production and all of the things that go with it is called
Saudi Aramco.
Aramco, which is the Arab American oil company.
Right.
Which is
all
not
all
American
because it was nationalized.
Yeah, it was. They just said, "Hey, this is mine, and this is mine." We have a cat that does it.
Yeah, too. Mine.
This is mine.
Mine.
This is mine.
Yeah.
And so the world is once again changing, and it's changing on a global level, and we're part of that.
And I've got what this means for the future real quick in a completely different area, and then we can come back. This is the last part of my expounding on the philosophy here. Okay. There are several areas in the United States where we have government-run institutions that are purportedly competing against each other, and we're going to have a lot of resistance to that being real competition. And one of those areas is the university world. We've got a lot of governmental institutions doing that. Even private-run universities are largely government-funded. We have new technology on the scene. It's been here for a decade or more. The ability to go to school online. The ability to verify that it's you that's doing it. Those are both things that we have the ability to do.
Right.
Which means that the long-term future for university education is, I would not be surprised to see many of our existing colleges and universities bankrupt in 15 years, maybe sooner.
Yeah, that's – and one of the things that I read a lot about in that area, which relates to everything else, is how expensive a university education is and how much debt to get through a master's degree or a doctorate, particularly to get the higher levels of income, how much money a person has to borrow and how long it takes them to get it back. Whereas,
and that's based on a system very much like OPEC.
This old guy that's limit sitting supply. Here could either by borrowing relatively small amounts of money or the GI Bill or with a little help from my parents, I was able to get through school and not carry a big burden into the rest of my life. There was a conscious decision about the time long, long ago when I was in college by professors who traditionally, by the way, you remember the professor, there's this image of the absent-minded professor, the professor with patches on his the jacket.
Sports jacket, a smoking jacket, yes.
Because the elbows wore out and they couldn't afford a new jacket because professors were poor. Well, today professors tend to be quite wealthy.
And now those patches are
the
fashion.
Stylish, right.
Fashion and only.
So the professors decided to limit the number of seats available at colleges and universities around the country, at the same time, by the way, as physicians decided they were underpaid, and maybe they were.
Well, again, there's...
The American Medical Association decided to limit the number of available seats at medical schools.
Now, this is, again, a governmental-run facility. When you're talking about the education of doctors, and you talk to almost any doctor about this, if they're at all familiar with the funding... A very large portion of their medical education was paid for by the government. Their residency salary was paid for by the government. Their internship salary was paid for by the government. If they interned or residented at a large hospital, that's where the money came from.
Still does.
Still does.
And as a result, medical costs have gone to staggeringly high numbers. I don't know what the solution is to this, but I kind of suspect it's computers.
Yeah, at some point.
But I'll tell you, when we all agree in our society that something is outrageously expensive.
Either somebody comes in with an alternative, which is very hard, the resistance on the governmental side is going to be there, or we stay at a high level forever. Well, what has been the history of that in the United States? We don't do that. Some alternative rears its head, and I don't mean air quotes alternative medicine. I mean alternatives to the prices that we're having to pay because we're all focused. The Senate threw into their tax bill kind of last minute this week of getting rid of the mandatory tax for the – Affordable Care Act, which put the whole thing in danger, but let me we're focused really hard on insurance, as if insurance is the reason why medicine is expensive. Dude, that's kind of silly. It's like going to the car insurance people because Ferrari is charging too much for their vehicles. That's
yeah. Well, if you had insurance that allowed you to buy vehicles with your insurance, that would make sense.
Right, and that's the point, is that we now have kind of mandatory coverage, and we've got to play some commercials.
Yeah, and I've got a little more to talk about oil.
Okay, so let's play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join in the conversation, the phone number here is 773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if you'd like to give us a call and talk about anything economic. And I'm going to talk about – are you done so I can talk about Earl?
Yeah, let's talk about oil.
You just got a little bit
– 4 minute stations.
4 minute stations.
Yeah.
China, separately from the IEA announcement that we are rapidly becoming and will be the dominant producer of petroleum on the planet. 80%, by the way, IEA said, and I was able to validate it from other places like the Petroleum Institute. The United States of America will probably be responsible for 80% of new oil found and produced between now and 2025. I don't know why they were locked into 2025, maybe because they started their data in 2015 and it's a 10-year period or something. So over the next decade or so, we're going to be roughly the United States of America, looking at the numbers and the way this works out, will conceivably be producing half or more of the oil on the planet. I don't know if that's mind-boggling to you. It is to me.
We were there and at one point in our past. To be back there is kind of something I didn't expect in our lifetimes.
A couple of things fall out that I haven't read any articles on, but when you put two and two together, they do come out. And that is that China will need to develop an energy infrastructure, including energy generation, the size of the entire U.S. power grid between now and 2040 to keep its head above water. We'd like to do this is one of those things that we're going to do this. They're going to burn a lot of oil to do that, and there's only one place they can get the oil, and that's us. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Person of Wealth.
Just have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. You're on the air.
Who is this?
This is the Person of Wealth Coach at KTEM.
Well, I think we got a wrong number.
Sorry.
All right. Well, at least we got a call.
Yeah, I wouldn't call us.
So we have a caller who wasn't listening.
I wasn't listening either.
That makes sense to me. Well, any rate, this is going to be profound. And it may be one of the reasons that when President Trump arrived in China, he didn't beat them up over unfair trade practices, because they're going to be one of our biggest, if not our biggest, customer on oil. And the trade balance between the United States and China is going to reverse, probably going down the road where they're buying a lot more from us than we're buying from them.
And it won't be that long away. This is talking about the next 5 years or so. It's already there. Our trade balance has already started to even out as their labor costs have come up and their demand for oil have come up.
And there's more we could talk about, and I do want to talk about next hour about this, but this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we are coming to the end of our first hour. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we are available. We do manage money for higher net worth people, and we also take advice from you on what we should be talking about on the air. So you can give us a call locally at our office. We have voicemail on the weekend, people during the week, 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, The Personal Wealth Coach, or TPWC.com, and you can read our philosophy, listen to podcasts of this program and others, and read our newsletters. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM 1400, your home for news radio in Central Texas, Temple, Belton, Killeen.